Well, I think, you know, the characters might be New York and many of them Jewish, but I think that they were such great characters and dealing with such relatable problems that people really connected to it. It did not matter if they lived in the middle of Nebraska. They still, you know, wanted to know what happened to these characters and loved watching them.
Now, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld came up with this idea of the meeting that you talk about in a Korean restaurant. It was important to get the other players right in this to put together what became known as the Big Four. Now, Jason Alexander came along after he'd been seen in a Tony-winning role on Broadway, but there were some other pretty well-known actors that auditioned for the part of George.
Yeah, there were a lot of in play for that role, and they were very different. It was like David Alan Greer and Steve Buscemi and Nathan Lane. It was like a real grab bag of types. So I think they really were not looking for a specific type. They were just looking for what felt right for them.
Now, as far as Michael Richards, that was a fairly easy choice because he had worked with Larry David on a previous show. The struggle was coming up with the right name for his character because, the real Kramer, Kenny Kramer, wanted to be compensated for that. And I guess it came down to the fact that the K sound is a funny sound.
Yeah, they just liked the sound of the name Kramer better than anything else that they came up with. So they did, in fact, drop some paperwork and have an agreement with Kenny Kramer to use his last name, obviously. They made up probably even a better first name for him, which turned out to be Cosmo, but that was much farther down the line.
And in reading about the rehearsal process as well, it seemed that Michael Richards approached his role a little differently than everybody else. He was kind of inwardly focused, it seemed.
Yeah, you know, I feel like my vague experience with looking into sitcom cats and writing about them is that there's almost always one of these, you know? There's almost always somebody on set who, even though it's a sitcom, is kind of a method actor, has a different process, wants to, you know, do it differently and be really into the character and, like you said, inwardly focused. He was the only one who would, like, you know, sometimes put on parts of his costume, even during the read-throughs and rehearsals, that sort of thing. And he really did not like it when his co-stars broke, which was often because he was very funny.
Well, there are so many little surprises and stories in this and behind-the-scenes tales, and I had no idea that, and I guess I had forgotten from the pilot, that Elaine Benes was not the original lead female character.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a woman in the pilot. She had a very minor role. She was a sort of wise-cracking waitress. And it seemed like they were maybe going in the direction of having that be a character, a recurring character on the show. But when they decided to make more episodes after the pilot, NBC insisted that they add a female character who was outside of the diner, could move around with the guys as easily and really be part of it. And, you know, the original character was great, but Elaine is obviously an amazing character and we were lucky to have her.
And both Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David thought it was important that the characters of Jerry and Elaine, though they'd had a prior relationship, didn't stay together and that relationship didn't draw away from the larger story.
Yeah, I think that's one of their best decisions, honestly. There's this very strange, if you watch them in order, which is easy to do now because it's on Hulu, there's this really weird early episode where they sort of decide to try to be a couple. And it's an uncomfortable episode if you know the show because it's like kind of their like feelings expressed. And, you know, like that's very unusual down the line later. But they come back from that episode, the next episode, and pretend it never happened, and it never comes up again. They just decided they didn't want that Ross and Rachel or Sam and Diane, you know, will they, won't they, to kind of take over the whole show, which made it very different.
We're talking with author Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Her book is called Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. I loved your earlier book, too, Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted, about the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And I wondered if in some way the character of Elaine Benes was maybe the next evolution of women on television, to go from a single career woman in Mary Richards to Elaine, who not only was single but had lots of partners and a pretty open social life.
Yeah, definitely, and is not necessarily, you know, Mary's very admirable. Like, everyone wants to be Mary Richards. I kind of want to be Elaine Benes, but, you know, I know that that's not that's the thing you're supposed to want to be. And I think that she was a role model of sorts in that sense of, we didn't have a lot of women on television at that time who, as you said, openly had a sex life, unapologetically, was not necessarily concerned about getting married, and also was not necessarily always a nice person. And what I was really interested in this, obviously, and what I found out from talking to the writers on the show, who were mostly men, I thought I would hear from them kind of the standard, like, oh, it was really hard to write for Elaine because she's a woman and I'm a guy. But I was very pleasantly surprised to not hear that. Instead, they said, yeah, we just, you know, when we were coming up with storylines, we'd have a list of storylines we wanted to give out to the characters that we had experienced in our own lives. And we would just give them to Elaine, the same as we'd give them to the guys. And we didn't necessarily distinguish girl storylines from guy storylines. And I think that's what helped make her who she was.
Well, while we're talking about the writing process, let's chat about the writers. I found that one of the most fascinating parts of the book, the fact that Larry David saw the writers as what you termed an idea farm. And he wanted real-life stories. He didn't want sitcom-y type of situations. And so there was a pretty heavy turnover in the writing staff.
Yeah, it was usually every season he would kind of get rid of most of the writers, bring in new writers. A lot of the people who came to the show to write were not TV writers. They had little TV experience. A lot of them were stand-ups, mostly. And they would kind of, as you said, use up stuff that had happened to them in their lives and then go on their way the next year. It seemed like it worked out pretty well for everyone. You know, they got to leave with a Seinfeld credit. That did not hurt at the time. And they had that experience, and many of them went on to write for lots of other shows. And then there are a few who kind of were mainstays and really, really could write like Larry David, essentially. But most of them kind of cycled through pretty routinely.
And Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld wanted the show to be unlike anything else on television, and that even extended to the music. Can you tell the story of how they got involved with Jonathan Wolff?
Yeah, it was one of those, like, showbiz, like, somebody knew somebody and asked this guy, Jonathan Wolff, to do the music. When the show came back, it's important to note that the first show, the pilot, aired alone in the middle of July. That was it. Like, there was no rest of the show. It was kind of billed as a special. What it really was kind of just dumped, you know, and presumably was not going to be picked up again, but the executives at NBC liked it enough to bring it back for another 4 episodes the following summer, and that's when they added Elaine, and they also changed the music, and that's when they hired Jonathan Wolff, who had done, you know, other sitcom music before that and had a business doing it, but he was also a friend of a friend. And he put together this very strange music, which we all know now, which is just the slap bass and a lot of noises he made, like popping noises with his mouth and stuff like that. And that was it. And the main reason they wanted it to, the main reason he went with that sound was because when the show was first on, they had openings that were Jerry Seinfeld doing some stand-up, and it kind of had to intersperse with him doing that. And so it couldn't be this big blasting music with lots of lyrics and things like that, which was very common in 80s sitcoms that he had done before. So that's sort of how he ended up coming up with that very spare sounding music that we're so used to now.
Well, other shows have had ensembles and expanded those ensembles, like Mary Tyler Moore and Barney Miller, Taxi, and some of the great sitcoms of all time. But I don't think any had the kind of huge recurring cast that became a part of this show's legend. And some would stick around. Our friend John O'Hurley as Jay Peterman, Larry Thomas, who played the Soup Nazi, Estelle Harris. These actors, this had to be a great gift for these actors, even though some of them have ended up playing either those parts or variations of them for the rest of their careers.
Yeah, they really had this gift for making supporting characters. Like you said, I think they just were so good at coming up with characters that even, like the Soup Nazi, for instance, was only on one. That's one episode. And people usually think he was on more just because he made such an impact. But besides the finale, where a lot of people came back, he was only on one episode. But they often had these episodes that were kind of showcases for these ancillary characters. And I think that's why that ends up happening, is that, you know, they did hire great people, but they also came up with great recurring characters, many of whom showed up multiple times also, like the parents, who were amazing. And I think it also gave it this feeling of its own real world. You know, it's like that's how life is that you have recurring characters in your life. And they were very colorful, and we always remember them, people like Newman and Putty. You know, it feels like it. Real life that way.
Well, and real life also for a number of people, because a lot of real names were actually used for the characters.
Yeah, a lot of them were inspired by real people. Like we were talking about Kenny Kramer. They also often, you know, they loved good names. I've become addicted to it too. Now when I hear certain names, I'll be like, it sounds like a Seinfeld name. You know, they liked funny sounding names, and one of them was Joe DiBola, who is just a, you know, television producer who's been around a long time. He was at MTV. He was later a producer for One Tree Hill. And he knew Larry David, and Larry David just liked his name and asked if he could use it and didn't really say what he was going to use it for. And that character eventually became Crazy Joe DiBola, who came up several times throughout one season and ended up, you know, like stalking Elaine and being really creepy. And I talked to Joe DiBola about this, who is not at all crazy. He's a very nice, normal guy from Brooklyn originally, a great Brooklyn accent. And he said that, you know, his life really did change because of the use of his name. You know, he started, first he was nervous, but then he noticed he was like getting better tables at restaurants and things like that. And he was like, think either people think I'm more famous than I am because they just recognize the name, but they can't figure out why, or they're scared of me. And either way, it sort of works out. So.
And even some of the movies that popped up along the way were actually based on real works, including the great, my favorite, Prognosis Negative.
I love those. Everybody loves those fake movies, right? There's a lot of homages to them online. People make new movie posters for it. Sack Lunch is another great one. Tunnel.
Right.
There's so many good ones. And Prognosis Negative actually did come from a script that Larry David had written, I think, before Seinfeld. I might be getting that wrong. It's either before Seinfeld or when he left, right after he left Seinfeld. And it just sounds funny, you know, because you can imagine what those movies might be about, but you're not quite sure. That's what's so great about them.
Well, I was quite surprised, pleasantly so, late in the book to see a friend of our show come up, Josh Gondelman, who now writes for Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and was one of the founders of Seinfeld Today, the Twitter feed, that apparently Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld weren't particularly impressed with.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, it's like one of those things you kind of start on a lark. It's only Twitter. It can only be 140 characters. Josh is extremely funny. And Josh and a friend started that on, you know, like, oh, they were just thinking, like, you know, so many Seinfeld plots would sort of be ruined today just by the fact that we have cell phones. Like, when they're all roaming around the movie theater trying to find each other, like, that would be solved by one text. That would be the end of the show. But then they were thinking of all of the other things that would come up because of technology that these people would struggle with, like online dating or, you know, buying stuff online or that sort of thing. So they came up with this idea to sort of do one-line pitches of what Seinfeld plots might be like today, and people went crazy for it, so much so that Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld started to get asked about it a lot and were kind of, you know, reasonably irritated by the idea that someone could think it's just so easy to toss off, you know, Seinfeld episodes when they were extremely picky, as I can tell you, many of the writers told me that they would often think they had great ideas. And they'd pitch them, and Larry and Jerry would be like, eh, no, you know, there's more to it than you think there is. Still, it was a funny diversion for a while.
And I understand, too, Jennifer, before we let you go, that your favorite scene is also my favorite Seinfeld scene of all time, and it's George's encounter with the whale.
Yes, that is, it's, for some reason, you know, I think we all have different favorites. They just, and for no apparent reason, it's just some stick with you and others don't. And I just love the whale monologue at the end of that episode. The sea was angry that day, my friend. I just think that's like the pinnacle of Jason Alexander's skills and performance, like that great way that he brings so much dramatic commitment to playing a very funny role, and that's why it's so funny, is because he's so dramatic about it. I just love everything about that.
And I thought one of the really touching moments in the book came when you were talking about the last episode, when Jerry gathered the other three together and said, for the rest of our lives, nobody will think about any of us individually without thinking of the other three, and I couldn't have three better people to be associated with.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? And it's so true. And honestly, I think it's touching partly because a lot of the time you sort of hear about people wanting to resist the roles that made them famous afterwards. They don't want to talk about them. And it's such a disappointment. You know, I understand it from their perspective, but it's often such a disappointment to fans. And I think we've sort of seen this from this cast that they must be tired. In some ways, tired of talking about this. But you know, without going overboard, they seem pretty, they understand that this was so huge in getting them to where they are. And even if they had to deal with the Seinfeld curse afterwards, you know, it was still a great thing that they got to do.
The book is entitled Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything. Just a wonderful read. Jennifer, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.